This is Albert Moeller. Welcome to Ask Anything Weekend Edition, this installment, Saturday, April 5th, 2014. Before getting to your questions, let me remind you of the importance of your calls. We want to receive your question, and we want to hear it in your voice. So give us a call at 877-505-2058. That's 877-505-2058. Now, let's get to your calls.
Hi, Dr. Moeller. My name is Bethany. I'm calling from Denver, Colorado. My brother and I have been having conversations regarding slavery in the Bible. He's not a believer, and he's pressed me about that. From the little bit of research I've done, it seems like amongst the Israelites, it was more like their form of filing bankruptcy. Rather than having to move away to a foreign land, they would become an indentured servant to someone else. But it also seems like the treatment of foreigners as slaves was very different. So I was wondering, what would be your response to a non-believer about slavery in the Bible as a whole, and also why it was allowed? Thank you.
Bethany, what a wonderful question, in the sense that that's a very serious question and one that's right on the front lines of a lot of conversations we have when people read the Bible, and as those who live in this modern world ask some very basic questions about what they're confronting. And in this case, sometimes it's also asked by someone who might be antagonistic to the Christian faith, saying, you're going to have to answer for this. So let's figure out how to answer for it. First of all, when you think about the history of humanity, the vast majority of human beings who have ever lived would have been defined in some way as being more slave than free. And our modern notion of people being able to own property and have the sanctuary of that property, to be able to be involved as economic agents, that's a fairly new development. As a matter of fact, in the grand span of human history, that's a very new development. And it still is a fairly rare development when you compare it to different places in the world, even in today's world. Slavery is one of those things that has to be very carefully defined, and we can read the Bible and come to a pretty clear understanding of what's going on there. And then we also have to understand that where we have people who aren't identified as slaves, by today's moral and economic modeling, they might well be considered as slaves. You make a very interesting point in the Old Testament. You say it's sort of a system of bankruptcy. Well, in the Old Testament, slavery was something that could happen to you in two different ways. Either you could be taken captive by someone outside of your own clan or tribe or people or nation, and you could be sold into slavery. For instance, when you have Joseph being sold into slavery by his brothers, he wasn't sold to fellow Jews. He was sold to those who were traveling from another culture and took him into captivity in Egypt, where he was sold as a foreign slave. If you were a foreigner back in the ancient world and you weren't with your own people, your own tribe, and your own nation, you were almost assuredly, in one form or another, a slave. In the Old Testament, there was another way to become a slave, and that was either temporary or voluntary. In terms of the temporary way to become a slave, you could be sentenced to a form of indentured servitude to pay off a debt, but there were limits on how long you could be kept as an indentured servant under that arrangement. The other way you could become a slave is rather permanent, but it was voluntary. You could decide that you want to be a part of someone's household, and you want to be their servant forever. And then there was this ceremony of the nailing of the ear to the doorpost in order to demonstrate the voluntary nature, the piercing of the ear, as we would call it today, in order to demonstrate the fact that you voluntarily wanted to be part of someone else's household. And in that case, you might be far better off than if you had no place to live. You would have a place to live, you'd be cared for, you'd be a part of a household and be included as a member of that household, even if you were a servant. And in the ancient world, as in much of the world today, where far more people are slaves than would be described as free, sometimes you would choose the form of slavery that you wanted actually to be bound to, the kind of commitment you wanted to be bound by. But it's clear that when you look to the Bible, to the Old Testament, and to the New Testament, the world was filled with slaves. By the way, the word slave that we use in the English language comes from Slavs, because those in Eastern Europe and Central Europe tended to be the places where, at least in terms of the late Roman Empire, slaves were drawn from. And that's where the word came down to us. But before we just come to the simplistic understanding that slavery always means one thing everywhere it's found, we need to fast forward history to the 19th century in Britain and in Europe, in Germany and in Russia, but particularly in Britain, where Karl Marx was writing the Communist Manifesto. And he and Friedrich Engels, in writing the Communist Manifesto, described all those who worked in the factories of England as slaves. And the point they were making is this: if you're working for someone else, if someone else has the power to determine your economic life, your economic future, then you are essentially a slave. Now, it's unfair to say that's being a slave in the same way that someone was held in chains in the ancient world and sold off to a foreign country. But Marx and Engels are making the point that slavery is what you have when you don't have an understanding of human rights and an agency, an economic agency, to act economically on your own. But Bethany, in terms of asking the question, we also have to come to a very clear and very honest assessment, and that is that about the worst form of slavery we could imagine was the race-based chattel slavery, as it was known, in the American slave trade, and especially in the American South. And that was a form of slavery that finds absolutely no endorsement in the Bible. As a matter of fact, it's not present in that way in the Bible. But that doesn't let us off from the moral issue of having to face the fact that the Bible does seek to regulate and humanize slavery rather than to eradicate it. And you look at that and say, why would that be the case? Well, it's because the societies at that time didn't have the notion of everyone being a citizen and an economic agent with individual rights. Societies were not based that way. Not one society was based that way. And so you couldn't just declare the end of slavery, because it would be absolute nonsense in a world in which there wasn't really another option for most people. You had the very rich who had the power of capital, and they owned property, and they then commanded the economic concerns and contributions of so many others we would call slaves. You look at it today, and Karl Marx would say, if you're working for a corporation, it's basically the same thing. That's not exactly fair. But on the other hand, it does demonstrate the fact that slavery doesn't always mean the same thing. And as much as we must condemn in the strongest possible terms the selling of people into slavery, and much less the race-based slavery that was characteristic of America throughout so much of our history, we recognize that's not actually what's being addressed even in either the Old or the New Testaments. But before we leave even this very brief consideration of slavery, we have to consider the fact that in the world today, not only outside the United States, but inside the United States, we increasingly come to know that slavery is still an issue. Even in these supposedly progressive and enlightened times, the selling of people into sex service and into slavery of a very different form is still very much there. The sex trade is indeed a form of modern slavery. And even as though many people would not define that as slavery, it certainly is by any conceivable manner. And that reminds us that this is a very close issue to us, not nearly as far as we might like to think. Bethany, thanks for your question, and I'll pray that the Lord will bless your conversations with your brother. Let's go to the next question.
Hi, Dr. Moeller. My name is Scott, and I am from Austin, Texas. As I followed your work, I've noticed that you enjoy classical music. This has evidenced itself in things like your recent article on Christian rap and comparing the music of Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, etc. I've also noticed your feud with Dr. Russell Moore in regards to the merits of country music versus classical music. Now, I must admit that as a Texan and a bit of a country music fan, I'm more familiar with lines like, "All my exes live in Texas," and also realize that your library is not going to exude lines like, "White lightning's still the biggest thrill of all," anytime soon. So my question for you is this: where would you encourage someone looking to explore the merits of classical music to begin their quest? Are there books that you would recommend that help to explain the contours and beauty of classical music that the average listener might not naturally pick up? And finally, what are some pieces you'd encourage the novice listener to familiarize themselves with? Thank you, Dr. Moeller, so much for the briefing. It has been a tremendous source of encouragement in my own life, and I look forward to your answer. Thanks.
Scott, thank you so much for that question from Texas. I do understand the priority of country music in many parts of this country, and quite frankly, it's better than a lot of other forms of music. Dr. Russell Moore and I have had a longstanding conversation, you might call it an argument, about the relative merits of classical music and country music, and in particular, country music and opera, but I'm sticking by my guns. I'm with classical music and with opera, but I will admit to you, from time to time, Johnny Cash is heard in my car and in my study, especially when he sings lyrics such as, "There's a man coming around taking names." A lot of that music's deeply infused with meaning and the biblical worldview as well. But when it comes to classical music, you say, where to start? Well, number one, let me just tell you that there are two ways to answer that question. First of all, I think you mean it in terms of Western art music. Most people just refer to that as classical music. You could refer to classical music, which is actually one specific period of time, and that about 1730 to 1820. I think you mean a much larger period of time. When most people talk about classical music, they're talking about that entire tradition of Western art music. And yes, I'm an enthusiastic proponent of it. You say, where to begin? Well, let me tell you concretely one place to begin. It is with some form of music service, whether it's Naxos or Spotify or Pandora or iTunes. There are going to be several channels of classical music where you can just listen. Oftentimes, some of these are just going to be free. You can go on the web and go to your local public radio station that has a classical program, and for free, you can often just start listening and decide, well, number one, what are you listening to, and what do you like? That's a good place to start. There are some other very good places to start, for instance, with some very important pieces of music. And you take the great composers, when you talk about Mendelssohn and Bach and Beethoven and Mozart and others, go for their violin concerti and their shorter violin pieces, because you will find oftentimes that these classical composers gave their most intensive art to these relatively short pieces of classical music that you will enjoy. Then I think of something like Bach's Brandenburg Concerti. That's the plural of concerto. And you start looking at this and you recognize there's just some marvelous music. And you open one door and it'll lead you into other doors as well. And then you'll come to understand the difference between, for instance, the worldview of a Mozart versus the worldview of a Bach, where Mozart is this kind of early Enlightenment secular figure who's writing, indeed, a lot of church music, however, and still can't escape that that Catholic worldview of which he was a part in the church culture that helped to produce the music he was paid to write. And then you compare that to Bach, who was that great agent of the Lutheran Reformation. And you understand, boy, there's a whole lot more than you might have thought. And then you get to Beethoven, who was basically a pantheist or a panentheist, and he's writing these marvelous pieces. By the way, the first piece of classical music to absolutely capture me was by Beethoven. It was his sixth symphony known as the Pastoral. And I got that album for 99 cents when I was about 12 years old, and I played it, I can't tell you how many times, on my stereo. It was a record player. And that music just worked its way into my life. I still play it often when I'm writing and when I'm studying. Beethoven's Sixth Symphony, the Pastoral. And you just look at this and you recognize there's so many ways to kind of jump in the pool and get to know what classical music's all about. If you want to read something, I would suggest Robert Greenberg's work, How to Listen to Great Music, A Guide to Its History, Culture, and Heart. That's a part of that series known as The Great Courses. He's a good teacher, and he will lead you to other sources as well. Scott, thank you so much for the question. Happy listening, but more than that, recognize that God gave us the gift of music, and I don't privilege one style or form or tradition of that music over all others. And so I think what we don't need is a form of elitism. What we do need is saying, let's understand that there is an enormous gift to us of this tradition of centuries of some of the best and most lasting influential music that a civilization has ever produced. Let's not lose track of that. And I think you'll also discover that it is a gift to you personally in ways you might not yet expect. So happy listening, and thanks so much for calling. Let's go to the next one.
Hi, Dr. Mueller. My name is Rory Chapman. I'm from Huntington, West Virginia. I'm currently an online student at Southern, though I will be there on campus within a year or so. First, I want to thank you deeply for your ministry and your efforts as the president of Southern. But my question concerns online schooling, and specifically for higher education. It seems like now more than ever, there's a push toward online undergrad and even postgraduate studies. And in fact, some seminaries are offering Master of Divinity degrees fully online and other degrees as well. Myself, having done both residential and online schooling, I see the benefits of online schooling for many who simply just can't afford to move for whatever reason, whether it be family or any other factors. But do you believe that online schooling is truly set to replace the traditional lecture-based setting? And what do you believe are the pros and cons of online schooling for higher education? I look forward to hearing you. Thank you very much.
Rory, thanks for your question. I'm so glad to know you're one of our students and that you'll soon be here in Louisville as well. And by the way, that tells us something. That tells us that you believe in online education, but that you aspire to something that would offer an even greater increase in your life and ministry, and that would be the classroom experience of actually being in a classroom with a teacher, with fellow learners, in physical presence, in real time, space history. That's really important. I think in one sense, as you introduce yourself, you kind of answered the question. But I'm glad to go on and offer some further thoughts for whatever they're worth here. I do believe in the digital revolution. I do believe in distance education and online education. I do not believe those who are saying this is going to replace the traditional classroom experience. And I'll even rather forcefully make that argument, because I hear people make that argument. They'll say, look, there's a tsunami of online education coming, so there aren't going to be any campuses, there aren't going to be any classrooms, it's all going to be online. And I say, look, I'll believe that. I'll believe you actually even mean that. When you need open heart surgery and you desire to have a surgeon who got his surgical education online. I don't think that person is going to actually, in any integrity, say that he wants an online educated surgeon rather than a medical school in the laboratory, in the operating room, with a skilled surgeon kind of learning that we really rely upon when we do need that kind of medical expertise. I don't think anyone in trouble really wants someone that got his law degree or her law degree online. I think we know there's certain kinds of education that are simply too massive, too comprehensive, too meaningful, too thoughtful to be reduced to just that. But on the other hand, I think we also need to recognize that the online revolution is real. And many things can be taught very well online. Some things, and I'm kind of surprised myself saying this because 10 years ago I didn't know this and might not have believed it. There are certain things that might be learned better online, or at least by some persons better online. There are some mathematics courses, by the way, that are demonstrated for adolescent boys as being more effective than a classroom situation. And who knows exactly why, but the learning skills of and the learning pattern of adolescent boys turns out sometimes to work better with an online program of programmed online education rather than having a teacher. And maybe there's a bit of the social engagement in the teaching of that particular subject that doesn't help a kid in that situation. Maybe he really doesn't need a teacher saying that's wrong. He needs a machine telling him he's wrong because that way it doesn't hurt his ego and he can just go back and correct it and make it a game and learn and press forward. And then there are some language possibilities online where there are some people who actually learn some of those language skills better online than in the classroom. But, you know, we both, I think, would accept immediately that there are just some huge areas of learning where you really want the person learning in the classroom with the teacher. You want the relationship that takes place there. There is an increase. There's a bonus. There's a gift in that that goes far beyond. I think it's really, really important whenever possible that people study on a campus with fellow learners and have the particular culture that comes with that campus, the gift of being in the ongoing conversation that's not just in the classroom even, but is in the hallway and in the chapel and in the cafeteria and in the community. So I'm a huge believer in traditional classroom education. I think something almost magical happens when you have a gifted, consecrated teacher in a classroom with wonderful and eager students. I think it's just incredible what can take place. I can tell you the desk where I was sitting in a specific classroom time and time again where some incredible new thought or new way of looking at the world came to me, and I was intellectually awakened. And sometimes even more than intellectually awakened, spiritually awakened to something that I don't think would have happened if I had not been in that classroom at that time with that teacher and with those who were learning with me. So I'm a huge believer in the priority of classroom education, that classical model. But I think the stewardship of opportunity that is invested in this school and other educational institutions, especially those serving the church, means we have to offer a multiplicity of platforms and different opportunities for those in different contexts and with different learning styles. And I just want students to move into that which will best equip them to serve the church of the Lord Jesus Christ and the cause of the gospel. I think for most people that's going to involve as much classroom education as possible. But I'm really thankful for how we're able to jump over walls and distances by thousands of miles in order to reach people with online education. And it's real education. I do believe in it. And I'm so thankful for your call, Rory. I'm thankful you're included amongst our students, and I'll look forward to welcoming you to the campus. And I just pray the Lord will bless every opportunity you have for study and learning, whether it's online or in the classroom, or for that matter, anywhere else. Thanks for listening to Ask Anything Weekend Edition. It was good to spend this time with you, and I thank you for your questions. Let me remind you of the importance of calling into those questions at 877-505-2058. That's 877-505-2058. Let me ask you to tell your friends about the program, and as you do so, remember the daily edition of The Briefing. That's a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview, Monday through Friday, every week. And that's found at albertmuller.com. It's accessible through the website or through iTunes or any number of other platforms as well. Let me also invite you to go to my website at albertmuller.com for regular updates, articles, essays, commentaries, and all the rest. This is a fast-changing world, and we're trying to think through many of these challenges together. And we're glad to hear from you at any time. Remember, our mail is simply mail@albertmuller.com. And we're also glad for you to follow us at Twitter. That's twitter.com/albertmuller. Above all, thanks for listening to Ask Anything Weekend Edition. Let's commit to this. Let's try to think as Christians together.